Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the battle over voting heats up in state houses and in Congress. This week, Democratic lawmakers in Texas walked out of the state capitol to block passage of a new election law. The bill proposes some of the tightest restrictions in the country on things like early voting and mail-in ballots. These conflicts over access to the ballot are playing out across the country as Republicans continue to spread false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. This has put major pressure on Democrats in Congress and the White House to take action on a federal level. Janae Nelson is Associate Director, Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She's an expert on election law and voting access. Janae, join me Friday morning. Janae, let's start with what happened this week in Texas.
Well, this week in Texas, Republicans introduced a voter suppression bill that is quite damaging to the ability of all Texans, really, to access their democracy on an equal basis, but particularly for Black and Latinx Texans who have been subject to these types of assaults on the right to vote for almost 10 years now, since the Shelby County decision and the state of Texas's effort to try to suppress the vote. It's an issue that we've been litigating for some time, and this new bill promises to be just as devastating as ones that we've challenged in the past.
Tell me what's in that Texas bill.
The Texas bill is quite sweeping. It's a 67-page law. It's quite complicated, and one of the main issues is that we think there will be an enormous amount of public confusion about the content of the bill because it is so sweeping and changes so many aspects of the elections that Texans have come to rely on. One of the most significant concerns that we have about it is the shrinkage of early voting, cutting not only the hours, but also the locations. As many people know, African Americans avail themselves of early voting opportunities at a disproportionately higher rate compared to other groups. There's often a movement in churches the Sunday before Election Day where preachers and clergy encourage African Americans to bring their souls to the polls. But unfortunately, Texas has chosen to ban drive-through voting sites, and they were used by Texans 125,000 times, 125,000 different voters in Harris County alone used that method of casting a ballot in the 2020 elections. The bill also bans late night voting and 24-hour voting, which is convenient for people who do not work consistent work schedules or who have multiple jobs or have other demands on their time and need to have a convenient time to vote. It prevents counties from keeping the early voting sites open until 10 p.m., as Harris County was able to do before then. And the reason that I focus on Harris County is because it is a very diverse county in Texas. And as I mentioned, with souls to the polls, when you limit voting hours on Sundays, that effectively eliminates the ability of churchgoers and this historic tradition of the African-American church working to get out the vote. It prevents that from happening in the robust way that it has in the past. This new bill prevents early voting on Sundays before 1 p.m. So this, in our mind, is one of the most direct signals that there is an attempt to target the very methods of voting that African Americans use most often and most robustly.
Wasn't there also an effort to regard the entire vote as being subject to overturning?
You mean in terms of recounts and...
Well, not only recounts, but that one official could say that this vote was not legal and overturn it.
Yes, it does make it easier to overturn elections. If a person makes an allegation that a candidate or anyone else from a candidate's campaign or someone who is acting with knowledge based on, I think there are about 9 sections of Texas elections law that a person can potentially run into trouble with. If they have a reason to believe that there's been some violation of law and they clear what is a fairly low legal threshold of a preponderance of the evidence, then yes, they can ask for the election to be revisited. And that is something that we've really not seen before. That really makes our democracy so much more unstable, because you can imagine that a provision like that will be used when a candidate is dissatisfied with the outcome of an election, or they want to create some doubt about the legitimacy of the candidate who actually won. So that is one of the most perilous provisions of this law, because it effectively invites election challenges in a way that just hasn't occurred in this country before the 2020 elections, when we saw a rash of frivolous lawsuits from the former president.
We're seeing these kinds of bills around the country. Tell me how many there are and where they are.
Well, they really are all over the country. The Brennan Center at NYU School of Law has done an excellent job of tracking them. And by their count, there are over 360 bills that have been introduced that would reduce the ability of voters to cast a ballot as compared to the 2020 elections. That's an enormous amount. We've seen laws pass in Georgia. We've seen laws in Florida. We now see Texas. We're seeing these occur in quote unquote battleground states like Michigan and Ohio. This is in many ways concentrated in the South, but certainly not limited to the South. And frankly, it's a tidal wave that is crossing the country in an effort to make our elections much less stable than they once were, and to make it far more difficult for voters to cast a ballot and exercise the fundamental right to vote.
And these state laws don't only restrict access, they also target who controls the election and certifies the vote. Have we seen that before, or is that something brand new?
The certification issues are, I think, an increasingly popular tactic that we're seeing that really weaponizes the office of the election administration official. We've seen in the past election officials being targeted, being harassed, being intimidated because of their participation in the election process. It has overly politicized and placed a danger on the people who are brave enough to help our election machinery run. And so the certification of elections is a part of that, and now I think adds another layer of potential invasion to the integrity of our elections and makes them more vulnerable to political assault, essentially, because like the ability to challenge an election or overturn a particular election result, the certification of elections has always or mostly been something that we've all agreed should be apolitical. But making them part of these voter suppression bills really changes the landscape in a very unfortunate way.
So Democrats in Congress are trying to do something to counter these laws. Tell me about Senate Bill 1.
So Senate Bill 1, the For the People Act, is it's a refreshing, comprehensive, and expansive overhaul of our election system. It really modernizes our elections in ways that respond to how people have been voting over the past decade or so. It's a way to make the standards that we've seen in different states and different locales across the country a nationwide standard when it comes to federal elections. It does essentially three things in principle. It makes it easier for Americans to vote without compromising security, I should add. It also takes big money out of politics, and it cleans up corruption in the government. And there are a number of ways in which it does this. It expands voter registration opportunities, which is the gateway to civic engagement in our country, getting people registered to vote. What it does is it allows eligible Americans to be automatically registered to vote. It also establishes same-day registration. And of course, we all have the freedom to remove ourselves from a voting list if we choose to, but it's wonderful to be invited into the participation of elections through this automatic voting registration system. It also prevents people from being removed from the voting rolls as easily as they have been in the past. Many people may recall cases that deal with a use it or lose it provision. Basically, if you don't use the right to vote for a period of time, you may be booted off the registration rolls. And that really shouldn't be the case. We should be able to exercise our right to vote when we feel it will be most consequential, when we are able to, and as long as we have registered and we remain eligible, there should be no reason that we are removed from the voting rolls. And Senate Bill 1 helps to prevent arbitrary removal on that basis.
And what about gerrymandering?
It helps with gerrymandering significantly because it creates independent redistricting commissions. And while those commissions have existed at the state level in a number of states across the country, it hasn't been a universal requirement. And because the Supreme Court ruled last term that partisan gerrymandering is a non-justiciable issue, meaning that federal courts can't really adjudicate claims based on hyper-partisan gerrymandering, it's helpful to have independent redistricting commissions take hold of the redistricting process from the beginning, which we hope would help avoid extreme partisan gerrymandering that has taken over the redistricting process in our country. And we're about to enter a very heated redistricting season following the 2020 census. And so this bill could not come any sooner in the context of the upcoming redistricting.
And so how much support is there for this bill? Is there enough support for passage?
That question depends on whether you're asking about support in Congress or support among the American people. The American people overwhelmingly support the Senate bill. If you talk to individual voters about the provisions in the act and you talk about what it does to enhance access to the right to vote, approximately 68% of people who identify as Democrats and a majority of people who identify as Republicans support those concepts. They support the idea of making it easier to vote. However, when you get to Congress, we know there is a sharp partisan divide on these issues, and that is what is deeply concerning, that the current debate in Congress around this law does not reflect the will of the people, does not reflect the majority sentiment to make voting easier and maintain the security of voting in this country.
So, how much chance does it have for passage?
Whether it is likely to pass depends on two things, and that is whether Democrats in Congress are able to convince their Republican colleagues of the value of preserving the integrity of our elections and making it easier for all eligible Americans to vote, which is something that a majority of Americans want. We know that Congress is deeply divided on these issues, and so it's unclear whether that bipartisan agreement can be reached in sufficient numbers to overcome the filibuster. And so the second aspect of that is whether the Democrats are willing to fight hard enough for our democracy to figure out a way to overcome the barrier of the filibuster to passing this type of legislation. And it could be through an exception to the filibuster for this type of law that is so integral to the integrity of our elections and the integrity of our democracy, or it could be a full override of the filibuster generally. But certainly, if they're unable to convince their Republican colleagues of the benefit and value of this, they will have to take some sort of measure to do that in order to succeed in passing.
And would it, if passed, supersede all these state laws that are being passed around the country?
The For the People Act applies only to federal elections. It creates a nationwide standard for all federal elections. But the effect on state elections will be quite profound. Even though local and state elections are not subject to this federal election law, they will undoubtedly be improved by them because it will be incredibly difficult for any state to run two separate election tracks. So the hope is that this rising tide of election laws will lift even the state and local election boats, if you will, to ensure that all elections are improved by virtue of this new legislation.
It would seem unlikely that Democrats would be able to persuade their Republican colleagues, since it's Republicans in these states who are trying to pass these more restrictive laws, feeling as though somehow if they do that, they can overcome the deficits that they experienced in the 2020 elections.
That's right. All indicators suggest that Republicans, at least at the state level, and certainly what has been said publicly, even in Congress, oppose these democracy expanding provisions and are in fact going in the other direction at the state level by passing voter suppression laws. But this really should not be a partisan issue. The Legal Defense Fund is a nonpartisan organization, and we see these issues as essential to the integrity of our democracy, that free and fair elections should be something that anyone of any party can stand behind because they fully believe that their platforms, their policies, and their positions can appeal to a majority of Americans, and that they are all willing and ready to be part of a fair and competitive fight.
How much do you believe the White House can actually do in this fight?
I believe the White House will have an instrumental role in pushing Congress members to think carefully about what's at stake in our democracy, to think about the moment that we're in and the moment that we have come out of, and how close to the brink of authoritarianism we came. And that this is a moment to call the question on the type of democracy we want to be. And that is the leadership role that the White House can play. It can also encourage those who want to push this legislation to take the very challenging steps that might be required in order to do so. And I'm very encouraged by the White House's commitment to this, and that our Vice President Kamala Harris will be taking on this charge.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Janae Nelson.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Janae Nelson, Associate Director, Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Talk about the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance provision and why that's so important.
So the Voting Rights Act of 1965 had a pre-clearance provision called Section 5 that required certain jurisdictions, certain places in this country that had a history of discrimination to seek federal pre-clearance, to seek basically pre-approval either from the Department of Justice or a district court in Washington, D.C., before they could implement a new voting law. And the purpose of preclearance was to make sure that we were going in the right direction in our democracy, that any new voting law was not going to put minority voters in a worse position than they were. So it would either maintain the status quo or improve the ability of minority voters to cast an equal ballot and elect candidates of their choice. Ultimately, the Supreme Court decided in 2013 in a case called Shelby County versus Holder that the way in which the Voting Rights Act identified the jurisdictions that should be subject to this federal pre-approval was outdated. Chief Justice Roberts said that it didn't reflect current conditions. And while we disagree very much with the analysis in that opinion and with that idea that Section 5 doesn't reflect current conditions, we did believe that it was an opportunity for Congress to take Chief Justice Roberts up on his offer to update the Voting Rights Act and create a more robust Voting Rights Act. And the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is just that. It is an update to the Voting Rights Act that responds to the concerns raised by Chief Justice Roberts in the Shelby County decision and also expands some of the best provisions of Section 5 and allows some of the work that it did to improve our democracy to extend nationwide. And it's a very exciting update to the Voting Rights Act. It's a necessary complement to the For the People Act if we want to truly modernize and overhaul our election system so that it is more uniform, so that it is more accessible, so that it is more secure, and most importantly, that it is more fair.
So as I understand it, that would mean a nationwide pre-clearance program?
It would require preclearance for certain known practices that typically result in racial discrimination. So there are two sorts of preclearance that are proposed in the Voting Rights Advancement Act. One is based on practices that we know typically harm minority voters in disproportionate numbers. So that would be stringent voter ID laws or voter purge laws or other laws that we have challenged routinely on the basis of racial discrimination. We also have another provision of the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Advancement Act, that allows for states to be put under a preclearance mechanism for all of their voting rights laws if they have a proven history of constitutional violations of the right to vote and other violations under federal statutes. So that's important because it now doesn't limit preclearance to just particular jurisdictions based on the history of the right to vote back in 1965, it now allows for more flexibility for different jurisdictions to come under the preclearance regime based on their current voting record and based on recent violations that they may have engaged in. So whereas Section 5 was concentrated on a lot of states in the South primarily, not exclusively, but primarily, the new updated Voting Rights Advancement Act could potentially apply to jurisdictions across the country if they have a record of
voting rights violations.
So on Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in an Arizona case that might further weaken the Voting Rights Act. What did that do?
Well, the Arizona case is one that deals with another provision of the Voting Rights Act, and that is Section 2. Section 2 has been a staple of the Voting Rights Act since its inception. It's been expanded over the years, and it is essentially one of the strongest tools that we have left in light of the disabling of Section 5. So Section 2 ensures that any voting rights practice or procedure does not make it more difficult for a voter to cast an equal ballot and elect a candidate of their choice. What we're seeing in Arizona is a challenge based on the fact that some voters have difficulty casting ballots in their assigned precinct. That could be because they work far from the precinct that is assigned to them based on their residence. It could be because their schedules don't allow them to get to that particular precinct, or they don't have adequate transportation for their assigned precinct. There are various and sundry reasons why a person may need to cast a ballot in a precinct that they haven't been assigned to. That's called an out-of-precinct ballot. And one of the claims in the case has to do with whether an out-of-precinct ballot can be counted for those elections that have nothing to do with the precinct to which someone is assigned. So, for example, if someone's voting for governor, it doesn't really matter what precinct they're voting from because it's not tied to that precinct. It's not a local office. It is a statewide office, and that ballot should count no matter where in the state it is cast. And there's also a challenge to third-party ballot assistance, where some individuals, and if you think about Arizona and you think about the population and the large number of Native American people who live in the state, many of them don't have access to adequate transportation or are unable to cast their ballots at the designated ballot location. And so third parties often help collect these ballots and deliver them to the appropriate election site. And this lawsuit challenges that practice. The concern here is that in defending those two practices that, again, make it easier for people to participate in our elections, that the constitutionality of Section 2 may be called into question. And obviously that is of deep concern, but we are confident that Section 2, which has been challenged before and upheld by the Supreme Court on every single occasion, will continue to remain intact and remain the same robust protection of the right to vote that it has always been. It's unfortunate that it has come up in this posture through these voting processes that are meant to actually assist voters and make their ability to participate in our elections easier.
And Janae, finally, given all that we've talked about, what do you see as the most realistic path forward for securing our country's free and fair elections?
I think the most realistic path forward is going to require firm and aggressive leadership on the part of the majority of elected officials in Congress who recognize the inflection point that we are at in our democracy and who are willing to do what is necessary to ensure that we have an expansive and well-protected right to vote. And that can only be secured through the passage of these two bills. And so that may require overriding the filibuster in order to succeed in passing this legislation. And I am confident that the American public will recognize sooner rather than later how essential that is to ensuring the integrity of our democracy and our free and fair elections in the long term.
Janae, thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane.
That was Janae Nelson. She's Associate Director, Counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.